Hello, and a very warm welcome to everybody at Take Britain today. I'm really delighted that everybody's come. My name's Anna Cutler, and I'm the new Director of Learning at Tate. And I've been in the job for 7.5 weeks now. So, you know, should I still be sounding a little uncertain of things? It's because I am. So I'm just finding out what the big picture is. But today's really exciting for me because risk is actually something very close to my heart, I have to say. And talking of risk, I've been asked to do a housekeeping thing, which is to say, should the fire alarm go off, which it isn't planned to and nobody expects it to, but either you run for your life, each for their own, or you go to the fire exit here, which is probably wiser. So there's a fire exit here and, of course, there's one there, so just to let you know that, as it's getting quite dark. I was wondering actually how to introduce this today, and I've been thinking about lots of different frameworks. I even wrestled Anthony Schrag on Margate Beach a couple of weeks ago to explore that risk. The bloke in front of me got his nose broken just before I did mine, so that seemed like quite an interesting proposal, and then I thought, that doesn't really cover everything I want to talk about, just my dodgy leg. So I thought, you know, what would be a good framework for starting to just introduce some of the ideas of today? A day that we really hope will be about dialogue and discussion, and although there are speakers, we're really hoping that we'll be having some great conversations and learning from one another today. So in the end, as chance would have it, my partner bought a book on science, and it's called, let me check, 13 Things That Don't Make Sense. And, of course, firstly, I feel jealous that they only have 13 things that don't make sense in science. Don't know how they've managed to work it down to just those 13. But there's a brilliant, brilliant opening to the book which describes what's going on in science, and I think there are parallels. So I'll tell you what he says. What he says is, he goes to a conference, and he says it's absolutely fascinating. And the first bit starts out with him watching Nobel Prize winners unable to work a lift. You know, they're standing there doing all this business, and he turns away slightly embarrassed, thinking he should help them, but also thinking that if they've just got the Nobel Prize, they should be able to work it out for themselves. So he leaves them to it, and then he thinks, this has been really fascinating. He says, it's been the most fascinating conference I've ever been to. Not because there was great insight, in fact, the exact opposite, because there wasn't any insight. We've all been to those. Let's hope today isn't one of them. But there was there's this huge scientific conference where pretty much nothing gets said, or what gets said is that they're stuck. And what he says is, this is quite an interesting place to be, being stuck, because it often brings with it some sort of revolution afterwards. And he makes a case for many of the big discoveries to have been established after these great stuck moments. And what he then goes on to talk about is Thomas Kuhn. And in his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, or rather the article, in the early 60s, in particular, he looks at the discovery, or he's trying to find clues to how people discover things. And it led to him defining the term that we're all familiar with now, and a bit of a cliche, which is the paradigm shift. And what he says is that, you know, people work in a certain set of ideas every sort of 20 to 30 years, a kind of broad ideology that we all test and trial and do whatever the current beliefs are we work from. And he says that even when one's starting and probably halfway through those years, evidence starts to build up that challenge those ideas. And what I love is, he says, most of those get ignored or sabotaged as you're trying to develop the evidence, perhaps, to make the shift. And he says, there comes a point when there is a crisis. And at the point of crisis, one has risk. And at the point of risk, one has revolution or evolution. And I think it's an interesting idea, because I think that partially that's where I feel often we are in our practice in museums and galleries, where we are busy trialing, and there's been a lot of research, some really good research and articles out at the moment that all kind of establish a series of arguments that I think we would all broadly move towards: long-term benefits of the work we do, working over time, stepping back, co-constructed learning, different frameworks for meaning and understanding. But we haven't actually moved into the next paradigm, to actually shift it there. And I would lay claim, and you can absolutely challenge me, that this might be a great opportunity to make that shift, and that actually the ideas that we form now will help make a shift in practice and in the work that we all know and we're probably all working on to some degree that actually takes us forwards. And I find that incredibly exciting, and I'm a great champion for us trying to do that. In fact, I think the biggest risk we could take is to stay in the last paradigm shift. So that's my brief introduction. I hope that kind of makes sense to you. I hope those are some of the thoughts that you might be having and others that you would want to contribute. I was going to stop there and just introduce today and leave it to my colleagues, but unfortunately, Felicity Allen, who set much of this up based on visual dialogues, has been unwell and is unable to present today. So I have stepped in, and I'm just going to cover some of the aspects that she was talking about. I do apologise, because it won't be in the great detail that I'm sure she'll have given it. But I think it might be helpful to frame it through an idea, through the Visual Dialogues programme that's been happening, and maybe just show you a bit of that, so that you have some sense of what we're talking about. So in the next 15 minutes, I'd just like to go through what these are and what this might mean, and hope that this might be helpful for the day. Visual Dialogues itself is a programme that's been initiated by Tate Britain, but it's in partnership with art museums across England and connects with national and regional collections, and that's really central to it. And currently we're working with Norwich Castle Museum, Norfolk Museums and Archaeology Service, Manchester Art Gallery, Museums Sheffield, which is the Graves Gallery in Sheffield, Tyne and Wear Archives and Museums, the Lang Art Gallery in Newcastle, and we will soon be working with Nottingham Castle Museum. And it's a really fascinating partnership. And I was part of a day only 2 days ago where we discussed the work that was taking place. And one of the things I can absolutely say, and I found fascinating, and that I thought was a clear benefit straight away, was that the work is being undertaken with young people, young adults on the whole, and it seems to be providing a platform that doesn't exist in any other place. You know, there's a very odd space for young people between GCSEs and moving into adult life or moving into further education, moving through your A-levels and what that means. And the project for me really seems to be developing some capacity for young people in making that kind of transition. There are various different kind of forms of work that are taking place across all these different partners. And I thought, is it useful if we just see a five-minute clip of something so that I don't describe badly what it is and you can actually see actually what it is? So is it possible to show that film? Hi, can we see the film? Thank you.
So we've been working on a project called Visual Dialogues, which is a partnership project run by the Tate Gallery, working with lots of different galleries across the country. And the idea is that young people aged 15 to 18 get to work with a gallery really closely, and they also work with a practicing artist throughout the project. Part of the project is to design the interpretation for a display at the gallery, and this year we've been looking at the collection of Goya etchings owned by Manchester Art Gallery, and we've got the contemporary loan of Jake and Dean Oschapman's Disasters of War. And the creative consultants have come up with various different ideas for interpreting these works. The main one is to create a sort of montage of TV screens, some of which function and some of which don't, which will have different pieces of footage all put together. And the idea of it is to show that we're completely bombarded with imagery of war all the time in our daily lives, but yet we still get on and sort of have a tendency to almost ignore it and just get on. So they're going to have footage of themselves and bits from the project, put over the top of war imagery from the news, but also things like cartoons and quite frivolous things, maybe the weather, just to show that war happens all the time, but we just switch over and watch something else.
We were just doing some green screen before this. Just comments about Goya and recording it so we can put it in the exhibition for the gallery.
We're going to combine footage of everyday war, like news broadcasts, and then to reflect Chapman's how they've made fun of war, we're going to put like cartoons and like the weather and just mundane things.
We had a fantastic opportunity to actually meet Jake Chapman, who was at an event at the Art Gallery in conversation with Tim Marlowe, who's the director of exhibitions at White Cube. And so the creative consultants were invited to participate in this event, where they listened to Jake and Tim talking about what had influenced and motivated Jake and Enos Chapman's own work. And it was really intellectual and quite hard work to listen to, but I think the best part about the whole evening was when the creative consultants actually got to meet Jake Chapman at the end, and he signed their books and drew original Jake Chapman works and defaced some etchings and things for them. And it was just fantastic because they realised that he was quite a nice, down-to-earth guy.
Really interesting that he really thinks about the work like intellectually. You sort of don't realise how much thought goes into it when you look at it. Even if you appreciate the work, you don't sort of think about all the ideas that have gone behind it. And he talked about his background as well, and how his background was quite different to what everyone thought. Everyone thought he must have had sort of a bad childhood because of his work, but he was actually like just as normal as everyone else.
The fact that he did actually made us think about his work. Like, from the beginning we were like, oh, he's just making another piece of work that naked people and stuff. But when he came to the talk and described the work, we were like, actually shocked and stuff. So there is a reason why you do that. There is a reason you actually talk about this.
But at first I thought he was going to be like, really, you know, like how artists going to be like, but then when he started speaking, started saying some jokes, I thought, this artist is really cool. Overall, it's been a really interesting experience because this is like something you don't do normally. Like, it's just like one-off thing. Like, so it's like a whole one-year project. You got to produce an exhibition in Manchester Art Gallery, which is not a little thing. It's a big thing, isn't it? And you get to learn about different artists and everything. Like before, I wasn't really used to being like artistic stuff and all that, but now I take interest in these kind of stuff, so it's kind of changed me a bit.
Have the house lights up just a little bit, or is it an on-off situation here? Just I can't see everybody. Maybe that's a good thing for me. Thank you very much. What was interesting about that for me, when someone was talking about it, Ronan was talking about it on Monday, he said that the talk with Douglas Chapman had been about, had been done for the Friends, and that they were a group of adults, you know, who were the Friends of the gallery, and they were very anxious about letting the young consultants come in on that meeting. And concerned, obviously, about all the things that people are concerned about, unnecessarily, actually, but about introducing young people into these fields. In fact, they had such a great time that the Friends actually asked whether they could invite those young consultants back for the next talk because of what they brought to that moment. And I think that's another thing that wouldn't have happened if people hadn't made certain decisions. So very briefly, I was hoping to just go through you, do a quick once around the block, really, of what I think might be the key issues about taking risks and what the benefits of risk are and whether it's worth it. So these are based really around those kinds of conversations. So I'm quite interested in the risks that young people want to take and like to take and take really easily whilst we run around like headless chickens. But they are not without risk, you know, and there are some very interesting aspects to it. So the first thing I thought about was engaging with something new, which is a risk, and it was clearly a risk for those young people who didn't necessarily have any kind of relationship with Goya, and it wasn't naturally the place that they would go to. And that really is of interest to me, because I do like the idea that we don't just reflect back to young people what they already know, that we actually have, if we're going to have some sort of collaboration, we need to be extending all of our knowledges. But that's a challenge, because that actually might mean that they have to take on something that they weren't expecting to, or it might challenge their own assumptions about things. Secondly, putting work in the public domain, that is massively high stakes, especially putting it in a gallery, and the young man said there, that actually it gives it huge value, but it's very serious. And we also know through research that giving high stakes to young people, and actually to older people too, but raising the stakes very high often brings up the standard very quickly. It develops language, and it develops thinking skills very quickly. So that kind of risk-taking, putting it out in the public domain, is a very high-stakes thing to do. But in my experience, it's something that young people have been really brilliant at doing and really wanting to take on. But it is not without emotional risk, because taking on high stakes means you also have to take responsibility. Young people as experts. The idea that we have power shifts, that, you know, we don't, as people who are managing and running things, we don't have to be in a position of power. I mean, we are in a position of power, but we don't have to structure the way we work in those kinds of systems, and I would hope that we could avoid doing so. But it does mean that they do have to take on additional responsibility, and it does mean to say they have to form some sort of empathy with those who are standing back and enabling that. Making the abstract concrete, I'm very interested in that, the kind of the purpose of transferring an idea into something made manifest and in the real world, in the real domain. That's a real challenge, because, as with everyone, the danger and the risk is not getting it right, not being perfect, not being as good as you need to be. I did a project once in a gallery where the young people, we worked for them to make an exhibition, and I took them to see lots of other exhibitions, and they came out of it, and they were very critical of those other exhibitions. And then one of them said, "Oh my God, that's what people are going to say about our exhibition." And it's a great moment, because that's true. So the kind of purpose and the way you articulate what you're doing and share that with people is also incredibly important. And then another risk is privileged access. A lot of people during our meeting, when we were talking about the partnership, said that having a privileged access to collections and to sort of back of house at Tate and back of house at the other galleries has been really fantastic. But again, not without its risks, because of the expectations made, the different, I mean, you know, on the bottom line, kind of health and safety issues. But there are a various range of risks that are involved in that. Privileged access. There are probably loads more thoughts you've got. For me, these were just some of the key ones that came out. And what interests me as I wrote this was I wrote risks to manage, because I think that institutionally, when we're thinking about risks, we don't think about them as risks to take necessarily. We think about, you know, mitigating them. And in fact, there's a lot of paperwork that enables us to do that. But I think it's very interesting, because these, you know, from the different sides, I see these things happening. So actually, for people to engage in something new might mean that we have to think about knowledge differently. That actually it's not necessarily about content delivery, but it's about how we share and develop new knowledges with people, and in this case with young people, that's really important. And it might mean a completely different preparation for people who work with young people. So it's not about content delivery to someone, it's about framing questions, framing co-constructive learning environments. It's a different approach. And actually, it takes a lot longer to not just deliver what you know, but to actually consider the whole of what you're doing. And that's a risk, because, you know, if you know something you do has an element to it that can be delivered and you know that it works, it's sometimes hard to move away from. Now, putting work in public domain, this is probably the one that comes up the most, which is, you know, the credibility and quality. And the first thing that people always say to me, is it going to be rubbish?
or how bad will it be, Anna? Very bad. We will make it really terrible, and then you'll be like satisfied straight away. The whole aim is, of course, that we maximise quality, and that actually this gives an opportunity for quality. But it also means, and I think that this might be a real issue, is about how we articulate what we're doing. And I think that's a really important aspect. If we can't articulate what we're doing, we can't describe and define what it is that we need to change or we're looking at. And I think that's an important aspect. Young people as experts, we are on the whole getting better, but I would say it's quite hard to step down when there are enormous responsibilities and pressures on people. And maybe not to step down, but to step back from having always to be the person who knows. And that's particularly difficult when you know a gallery or a museum, you know all the risks inherent in working there. I also think that's really incredibly important. We have to think differently about where we place ourselves in the learning experience. And then making abstract concrete and how we co-construct, how the abstract gets made manifest. We often don't know what it will look like. It's a huge risk, and we can't control it. I know that I often want to step in and go, oh, I mean, if you do, you know, and we have to really hold back from doing that, because actually the learning process is all about people finding that out for yourself. I had a great mentor once called Shirley Bosseth who said something to me about 10 years ago, and I only realised it a couple of weeks ago what she actually meant. And I said to her, "Why don't you just tell me that that was really important?" And she said, "Yeah, you just have to do it, Anna. There are some things you have to learn for yourself." So I think instead of trying to make everybody know everything, we have to let go. We have to let people learn. And lastly, privileged access. It's a big risk for particularly somewhere like here, where it involves such an enormous amount of people that you have to talk to. And it really demands cross-institutional work. And we need to talk to the marketing team, we need to talk to the tech teams, we need to talk about art handling. There are a great range of conversations that we need to have that actually work like this. Feels quite risky for us and challenges maybe what we've done before. But this is what I see as being the benefits from those. This is what the outcome is. And I think it is that we generate new methods of approach. That in shifting our practice and taking those risks, we will have new constructions of knowledge. That we will start to work with other people to not load a vessel and not just receive, but that together we might have something new and different. That's exciting to me. We'll have an improved articulation of our purpose and what we're trying to do, and I think perhaps we haven't been as strong as we might have been in trying to explain what the exact purpose is. You know, we're not trying to make every child an artist, we're not trying to make every young person an expert, we're trying to make everybody an expert to their level of desire and interest. So everybody has the right to be part of the conversation, everybody, and it's not impossible. I think what you get from this is trust. I know that doing programs like this here, we've started to develop huge amounts of trust across our departments, which suggests to me we're starting to have some sort of institutional change and development and a shift in practice. It's developed respect. Oh, I'm sorry, I've moved, haven't I? Sorry, I don't like this really much. I like this better. So we have, you know, it's just develop respect. And, of course, the first time you do something, which is really hard to achieve, the second time we do it, it gets easier, and that trust and respect grows. In fact, what you start to get then is some much better conversation, new conversations, and people with other expertise giving you more knowledge and more, better ways of thinking how you might do things because they come from different perspectives. And I find that very exciting. And lastly, I've just written, it generates new collaborations. And I think that, for me, the idea of wanting to move forwards and wanting to take risks is really sharing new ideas with new people and having the courage to take those on, having the courage to disagree, having the courage to navigate that, again, is a big risk and it's very time-consuming, but I would say is absolutely, for me, what it's about. So I'm going to stop there. I hope I've just outlined some of the things that certainly are in my mind about taking risks. My feeling is that the biggest risk is not to take some. And I think that right now, this is a great opportunity to really test and push ideas and really try and find out what the benefits are of those risks. Thank you.
Hello, I had something planned, and because you were talking about taking risks, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to go with... So I am going to make mistakes, and I am going to learn. So that's kind of what I'm going to try to do. So bear with me if I speak. I swallow my words sometimes, and sometimes I don't project myself in the way I'd like to. My name is Nivek Amichand, and I'm part of Tate Forum, which is Tate Britain's kind of youth program, or peer-led advisory group, as we'd call it. We don't really know what that means just yet, but we program and plan events for young people at Tate Britain, and we do most of the work. From the beginning, we were given only so much of leeway in the stuff, in the input of the outcome of our projects. But as we went along, as the years progressed, I started in 2005, and from 2005 till 2010, we've been given just a little say to creating a whole project all by ourselves, from speaking to design, just giving us the budget, breaking up our duties, as you will, and creating the whole project basically totally by Tate Forum for us, for young people, to express ourselves totally. And I think it took those 5 years for Tate to gain our trust and for us to trust Tate enough to give us that freedom. And I think that's quite important too. Although you give young people that responsibility, you also need to gain their trust and them to trust you as well. As I said, I'm kind of going back. I came when I was here in 2005, came over from South Africa, so I was 18. I didn't know anybody. Didn't know anybody in the country. Was quite lonely at the time. And I started working at Tate because I didn't have a job, so I was working in visitor services as a gallery assistant. And I decided to join the youth program because I couldn't find anybody my own age in London that I knew, firstly, and who I could befriend, because most of the people that work here are slightly... They're not 18, let's just say that. So joined Tate Forum in 2005, and I didn't know what to think, because for me, even Tate Britain as an institution was something... I had a stereotype in my head of what England would be like. I had a stereotype in my head of what Tate Britain would be like, just the building itself, the ethos, the history behind it, and the things that you would associate with it, maybe more conservative, if you will, not so open to younger people, only storing British artwork. It's kind of high up in the hierarchy of the art world, if you will. And it was very daunting to think, well, I'm not an artist, by the way. I forgot to mention that. I'm studying science, and I'm not a practicing artist, so I didn't have that knowledge. And I found art was, when I first joined, it was kind of like a cliquey thing. How would you get involved, or how would people react to you not having the same interest, or it's just a fear of the unknown, I would say. At first, I was overwhelmed at how these meetings where we program and plan events were so unstructured, yet we got so much done. And I think the main thing was it never felt like work. Whenever we came for meetings, it wasn't where we had objectives, but we had deadlines, but we never had pressure put on us to achieve those things. And that, I think, helped us create. It was more of coming together of friends, and I made lots of friends along the way, and it opened up a lot of doors within stuff that I wouldn't never have had the opportunity to do, basically. I think as young people, we look for that sense of ownership or that kind of belonging to something, because you're in a stage where we don't know where we want to be. And I grew up in a place where there was always a place to socialize, and there was always areas for me to hang around people my own age, be them run down or be them messed up, but there were still areas, fields, or places where I could go to be a collective with people my own age. And I find in London, it's kind of more difficult because there's not so many social places for young people to go. And I think art galleries like Tate, for example, are providing that platform where there's a place for young people to go, not only to socialize, but it gives you opportunities to try to express yourself in a way you would, firstly, and secondly, to give you opportunities to try. If you're not good at something, you can try something else. You could be good at marketing if you're not good at the creative side. You could be good at organizing if you're not good at another side. And you summed a lot of the things that I wanted to say in my speech up in that PowerPoint. So I was I'm kind of going in bits and bobs. Okay, basically Tate Forum as a group, we how we recruit new people or new young people is we have 4 taster days throughout the year, and those are days where we have workshops or events for young people to come to and experience what we do. So it's not just, and sometimes we try to give them a skill to take with them, like photography or some type of artistry or creative process. And if the young people like it and they come to our events and they want to be, they show commitment firstly, because I think that's quite important as young people. You want to try, but if you're committed, that's also what is needed. And you come to join Tate Forum, we welcome you in, and we start planning events for other young people. We have slightly less budget, a smaller budget than other galleries, believe it or not. And we have to do everything within that budget. So it's not just what we want to do. We have to take into account the food, the catering. As you see, there's many other peripherals that might be involved in an event. And when you start, you think, okay, we can just have an idea and we can do it. But it's not as simple as we would have thought in the beginning. Through Tate Forum, I was exposed to a creative group called Visual Dialogues. And we went to the Middle East in 2008, went to Syria and Jordan, and that was an amazing experience. We worked with art galleries from the respective countries, and we formed a collaboration. And I'm still in contact with some of the people that I've met along the way, young people. And we had a Tate, it was with the British Council at Tate Britain, and we had an exhibition at Tate. And it was our work that was portrayed. And it was quite good to see something that you do in the Tate. And some artists, I was speaking to Nick the other day, and it was some artists don't get the opportunity to do the things that I've been doing. And I'm not an artist, and I feel quite privileged to have that opportunity. And it's not only, as you say, it's not only about being an artist, it's about being a creative person and being a creative mind as a young person. So I think it's about getting that message across to young people that it's very welcoming, yet not so welcoming if you don't know about it, if that makes any sense. In October, I helped at Tate Liverpool to create a show which was called the Youth Mail Art Interchange Project, which I'm sure some of my colleagues will be telling us more about. And there were groups from England, Tate Liverpool, Tate St. Ives, 3 minutes, all right. Basically, it was a collective project. And I'm going to have to speed it up, actually. We all did a year-long project where we posted each other stuff, and we all responded in relation to each other. So if we got something, we would respond or do something similar to what we've got and post it physically to another country. So the network that we had was the galleries in England were Tate Liverpool, Tate St. Ives, basically all of the Tates. The Kia, 2 galleries in Finland, the Pompidou Gallery in Paris and the Reina Sofia Gallery in Madrid, which Reina Sofia, unfortunately, this year has dropped off. But it was a culmination of a year's work, and at Tate Liverpool we had a show where we brought together all of the work that we'd done over the year, and the art galleries from those countries came over, so we got to meet the people that we've been working with for the whole year, yet we never saw, and that was quite good. And we had about 3 days of non-verbal workshops, because there was a language barrier between the different countries, and that was also quite good, because we learned to communicate in a different way. And I think, how would you do that in another way? There is no other way to actually get that same type. I'm not articulating myself in the proper way, I know that, because I'm babbling on. But I hope you try to get the gist of what I'm saying. Without these type of things and without these type of platforms, there wouldn't be this type of dialogue between young people from different areas, and there wouldn't be this type of creative exchange, if you will. That's it. Sorry. I know I don't have much time, so I'm going to cut it. Thanks for listening.
My name's Chloe, and I'm here today to represent Raw Canvas at Tate Modern. This talk was written in collaboration with Eleonora Scanella and in consultation with the rest of Raw Canvas. Raw Canvas was formed in 2000 when Tate Modern opened to start thinking of ways for 15 to 23-year-olds to talk and explore artworks. It aims to recruit around 20 new members a year. After selection, a 12-week training course begins with the learning of new workshop skills. And speaking to members of staff across all departments, and ends with the development and proposal of a new Raw Canvas project to the rest of the group. Upon completion, trainees become staff members and get paid to plan, develop and deliver education events for 15 to 23-year-olds. Peer leadership is a founding principle of Raw Canvas. It provides an approach completely different to that of formal education. There are no right or wrong answers, and we are peers, not teachers. Our activities range from small-scale two-hour workshops, like this for Photo Box, who wanted to explore identity and urban photography. So we developed discussion topics and activities based on the work of Marlene Dumas and Valley Export, to large events in the Turbine Hall, attracting thousands of people. Here, experimentation is not bound by art form. The inclusion of music and film encouraged the belief that Tate Modern is for everyone. For one of our recent Tate takeovers, we collaborated with 3D design students from Camberwell College of Art to create an environment for people to make, break, and play with various interactive workstations. When making paper bricks to grow grass and flowers, people are exploring the potential of everyday materials, very much like Arte Povera artists, but in the relaxed environment did not necessarily perceive what they were doing as learning about art. In this way, these events encourage new audiences to perceive Tate Modern as a non-threatening social space where they can explore their own creativity without fear of being judged. Let's have a look at one of our projects in more detail now. We're all experts, and we were, Anna Cutler was saying quite a lot about young people's experts, is a series of events we ran in summer 2009. We invited individuals that we identified as experts to give a short talk about an artwork, followed by further discussion with the audience. To classify as an expert, you didn't need age or academic excellence, but passion and an ability to look at art through your own perspective and experience. By showing that an expert's view can rely on personal experiences and opinions rather than just on specialist knowledge, we share with participants our belief that there are endless ways of engaging with art, and they contributed to the making of an alternative art history by collectively coming up with an interpretation for a chosen artwork at the end of each event, challenging the authority of the all-powerful, all-knowing institution. This format allowed for the expression of voices that would not otherwise have been heard in the gallery, and not just by other young people. By using the relatively didactic traditional structure of the gallery talk, these events encourage intergenerational participation, therefore not only empowering those taking part, but the status of young people in galleries in general. We felt a real ownership of this project as we were involved in its development from beginning to end, and really enjoyed making our own flyers and placards to advertise our event. This ensured that we had a real presence in the galleries, which can sometimes be rare. The Group for Education in Museums suggested we submit this as a case study for publication as an example of good practice for young people in galleries. It's obviously extremely rewarding to receive this kind of recognition from professionals and people at high levels in the museum education field. The future for Raw Canvas is looking pretty good. Two Raw Canvassers, Katie Schwab and Roger White, applied for external funding from the Peter DeHaan Foundation and the Ideas Tap for outstanding projects in the cultural sector, and were one of the five projects awarded. The realisation of their proposal is 24 Harper Road, a programme of 20 workshops, activities, film screenings and discussions taking place during March and April in an empty travel agents in Borough. Participants in the workshops and activities will be people from the surrounding community, which is building on links already established by the Tate local team, and also as a place for Raw Canvas to meet and share ideas as practicing artists and creative thinkers as well as educators. This is a fantastic opportunity for Raw Canvas to be able to offer their own project, from securing their own funding, finding the space, fitting it out, meeting with community leaders and programming events. It's the first offsite project Tate Modern has ever done, and we're very proud that we, Raw Canvas, have been the people to do it. Apart from 24 Harper Road, we're currently re-evaluating both our work and our workforce. We feel we can do even better to represent young people in London and are therefore striving to create a greater diversity within the team and delivering a more risk-taking programme of events. We've developed a manifesto and development strategy, which we are looking forward to presenting to senior members of the learning department. So this is a bit of an exclusive. You can see we've started up the top with this idea that we really want to increase the transparency. Having a look more at our budgeting and programme choices, like Tate Forum are doing, having a real control over their budgets. And we're looking then, this should lead to a greater responsibility, motivation, passion, and as I said, a concerted effort to increase diversity within the team. And we're also really going for a greater visibility, both in the learning department and in the galleries, as we really think that's really important. And doing more sharing as well, so getting together more like we are today with other young people's programmes and other departments in the learning Tate family. Great, so this shows that when given the opportunity, young people have the confidence to present ideas in terms of strategy, and we're able to critically evaluate what we are and what we want to be. Because we're not just an advisory group, we are there in the galleries delivering our programmes, we can make changes where they are needed, and we're able to develop new thinking, grassroots definitions, principles and priorities. We aim to develop new concepts and strategies for young people in art institutions and be at the forefront of museums and galleries provision for young people. So what we'd like for you to take away from today is, when working with young people, let us lead our peers. This ensures that young people can engage with the institution through egalitarian relationships as well as the more hierarchical relationships with teachers or gallery educators. Trust us, we are capable of running our own events and handling responsibility, so please put us to work on it, don't just have us as advisors. And lastly, let us express, make, experience and imagine. This is how to develop programmes that are genuinely by young people, for young people. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Hello everyone. My name is Ralph. I'm 22, a member of Young Tate from Liverpool. I'm going to talk about some experiences that I had in Young Tate. And by the way, I joined Young Tate in 2008. Yeah. Experiences. The first time I joined Young Tate in 2008, it was like I was thinking like it couldn't be any place for me in Tate because I'm not an artist basically, and that was my first experience in Young Tate basically, and the most important thing for me was my language because. When I joined Young Tate, I couldn't speak anything. Like, I didn't understand anything as well, so I was just sitting. But after a couple of sessions, I feel more confident, more open. I joined I joined the conversations, I present my ideas with more confidence, and I spoke with different artists, so I think that was great. And I started doing the projects, which is Tate provide for young people. And we learn something new with each project. as we joined the project. In each project, we have a chance to meet different artists with different skills, with different backgrounds, which is great, especially for me and for young people, I think. The roles in projects, which any project that I've done, I played a bigger role in that project, which is very great for me. Sorry. Yeah. That's one of the projects, the first project that I've done with Young Tate, William Blake project, and why my first experience in doing the project and working with artists, and I've done, like, I was just taking a part of it, like, to making costumes. Color Tent project and lantern making, summer 2009. Summer 2009, it should be 9, sorry. was based on color chart, and we worked with an artist to come up with activities for young people, young children, and it was running for a week in Tent in Liverpool. And that's the picture of the young Tate members that been involved in that project. And I was leading the face painting in that project, which was the big role for me. And I was leading the lantern making as well in that project, so which was great and the first experience for me. The most recent project that we're doing and we're working on it called Use Art Interchange 2009-2011, which is a European partnership project between four galleries, Tate Liverpool, Tate Britain, Chiasma Helsinki, and Pompidou Paris, which is around democracy, youth participation, active citizenship, political and cultural debate, which is actually four projects in each side, until June 2011. And the umbrella theme for all four sides is the sense of perspective. That's the young Tate members that are working on this project. And we're going to have an exhibition in April 2011 in Tate, Liverpool. And we're doing the research now for finding the artworks in Tate collections to put in the exhibition. And I'm in the curating team and marketing team as well, which is biggest, like, when you compare it with the other project, is the biggest role for me, and I feel more responsible for it. What is positive? Well, that's a lot I can mention. Like, Tate provide an opportunity for young people to try something new. Like doing the projects, visit the exhibitions and new influences. There's a great place for young people to show their ability, like to come up with their idea, with their opinion, spend time. Great friendly environment to make and meet new friends, get involved in the projects, and as they do, they learn something new, they experience like something new, which is great for young people. Also, it is like, join Young Tate is playing a role in the community, being a part of Tate, and a great place being listened to. For me, it was, I think, for all of young people members, it is, because, as I said, the frustrating thing for me, as I mentioned, was the language, because when I joined Young Tate, I couldn't speak anything, I couldn't, like, understand anything, I was just sitting. And as you can see now, I can speak. And sometimes, like, it was like, when I was trying to say something and say, like, give my opinion about an artwork or about something, it was so difficult for me to put words and get my point across. Future of Young Tate. As a part of Young Tate, I think after the exhibition that we are doing now, the recent project, which is Youth Art Interchange, if you could like have more input into decisions about exhibition at the gallery, that would be great, a great experience. And as a member of Young Tate, for Tate, like, I don't know what to say, but something like completely different to what Tate is now, what Tate do, which is like having an exhibition for contemporary art, like fashion design or fashion exhibition, which is completely different, I think. Another thing is qualification and ways into work. If with any project that young people doing in the Tate, it would be a qualification or some way, like something that shows young people that you could do that thing, and for their CV or something for their future, that would be great. Keep them more active, more exciting, and getting more involved in the project and in the Tate, especially Tate projects. And the last thing is, if there was exhibition space for young people, like young artists and emerging artists, if they could put their work in that exhibition in Tate, I think that's a great place for them, so they can show up their work. And thank you. And I don't think there's enough time for questions, but there's 12:30 question time. Thank you.
Hello. I'll just get my Mac. Okay. Hello. My name's Katie, and I'm from Young Tate St. Ives. Okay. For this presentation, I asked one of our longest-serving Young Tate members, Ella, to give us a quote about what Young Tate St. Ives was all about. And she said, "Young people who love art, sharing ideas, creating new, exciting opportunities, organising interesting and alternative events, just generally making merry in a gallery." Young Tate St. Ives is for 13 to 25-year-olds, led by peer leaders who are 16 to 25 years old. Our Young Tate peer leaders get involved for various reasons, such as to enhance their skills and experience for their CV, as a way into getting some paid work that's relevant to their interests, to make friends, build their confidence, to learn about art and how galleries work, and even as a hobby to keep us out of trouble. So I'll just try this. Yeah, okay. Our audience varies according to season. For most of the year, we have students and local young people. So we do events like Young Tate Talks all year round, which enable them to have a look and find their own interpretations of the artworks. But in summer, we do beach workshops, and we find the summer visitors just come along for something to do while they're on holiday. Right. We've planned events such as a fashion show and a silent disco, which are aimed at a young adult audience, but they're open to all. Because they're generally like public events, but just targeting a younger audience. We're also sometimes asked if we can get involved with more specific projects. For example, we selected and projected Barbara Hepworth archive film footage all around her house and her studio for a midsummer members event at the Barbara Hepworth Museum. Now, I'm involved with peer leader training, where alongside the gallery staff and an artist educator, usually two peer leaders also assist in delivering the training, which I really enjoy because I feel that my knowledge and skills and experience are being valued, and I'm given the opportunity to share that and empower others. Now, a really huge step for Young Tates and Ives is that in October we were offered a place on the Tates and Ives Advisory Council, who meet three times a year and represent the gallery stakeholders. This is important to us because now our young people have a voice that can be heard at director level. We also recently had the opportunity to choose an artwork for the summer collection display. So six peer leaders each chose an artwork that they thought would be suitable for the show and pitched them to the Young Tate group, who then voted for the piece that they thought would be best. And they chose a Robert Ryman piece called Ledger. On that day, we also discussed our ideas for what Young Tate wants to do next. And our priorities are to rebrand Young Tates and Ives, develop a training plan for peer leaders, and develop a training plan they can deliver for others, including like other gallery staff. And we're also going to map out a key event for the end of 2010 targeted at local young people. Most recently, I've been involved in an Inquire project with the Creative and Media Diploma students who are around 14 years old. For this, six Young Tate peer leaders, the formal and informal learning curators, and the Creative and Media Diploma teachers have all like joined forces to deliver lessons for the next two terms. And for me, this is a fantastic experience, as I'm really interested in education. Therefore, I hope to learn a lot from this, as well as pass on what I already know to the students. So in conclusion, Young Tates and Ives has been such a valuable opportunity for learning through experience about not only art, but for developing skills and exchanging ideas.
Yeah, I see what you mean, it's quite bright. I'm not Carmen Mersch, by the way. My name's Emily Pringle, and I'm kind of what you describe me, really. I'm coordinating today, but what I would like to do is to introduce Professor Carmen Mersch, whose job title is multiple, but you are head of the Art Institute in Zurich. Head of the Institute of Art Education, please forgive me, Carmen. I've known Carmen for many years. She is an extremely experienced and wonderfully interesting practitioner whose own interests and work kind of cross boundaries between practice, education, and research. And she's going to talk here about her work on the Documenta 12 programme, which I think was in many ways very groundbreaking because it was introducing and grounding, foregrounding education within the context of a biennale. So, Carmen, I'd like to hand over.
Oh, wow, this is bright. Hello. Well, first of all, thanks a lot for inviting me, and I have to say it's really difficult to talk now after this wonderful presentation. I feel very privileged having been able to be here and listen to you, and I have to say I'm really looking forward to the moment when I can find similar activities and programs in the country where I'm coming from, Germany, but now I'm living in Switzerland. I work at the University of the Arts in Zurich, and I'm the head of a research institute dedicated to art education, gallery education, also arts in schools. And therefore, I will give you a bit of a research perspective today. We did a participatory action research project on Documenta 12 education, and I tried to link that with the topic of today's symposium, the topic of risk and also the question what kind of learning the institution may take out of taking these kinds of risks in the framework of educational programs. Somebody, because I arrived a little bit late, somebody has to explain to me how to manage this. Is it this one? Is it easy?
Yeah. Just press
that. Ah, okay. Good. So I start with an example of one of the research, of the singular research projects which has been undertaken in the framework of this participatory action research project at Documenta 12 Education. We worked together with 21 educators who were doing guided tours, basically. They were also doing other things. I will tell you shortly, a bit later, but basically we worked with 20 of them who were conducting guided tours every day, and they met weekly in this team-based research project to talk about the problems which would come up during the work, and they developed research questions and research designs. And one of them was Hansel Sato, and the essay in which he presents the results of his research, he starts as following. Having led a number of tours at Documenta 12, I noticed that a significant number of German participants reacted with surprise or rather skepticism when learning that a non-European foreigner was to conduct the tour. After introducing myself at the beginning of the tour, I would often be questioned as to my origins. I would oblige and provide additional information of my nationality. I lived for 28 years in Peru, where I was born. Recently, I acquired Austrian citizenship, and I have been living in Vienna for 10 years, where I obtained a degree in painting at the Academy of Fine Arts. My father is Japanese, and my mother Peruvian. My mother tongue is Spanish, and I speak German fluently. So this is the start of his essay. And actually what Hansel experienced day by day in doing guided tours at Documenta 12, we could easily name structural or also daily racism, because he got comments like, would you do it cheaper for us because you're not speaking pure German, or we are waiting for a German guide and things like that. So it was quite a violent encounter. He is a person who is very positive, optimistic, and of very good humor, but after a while it started to get on his nerves. And so in the research project, we tried to develop, together with him, a research design which would answer to these kind of experiences in a productive way and turn them into something you might call a learning experience. So what Hansel then did was that with 5 guided tours he did, he would introduce himself each time with another aspect of his constructed identity. To one group, he presented himself as a Spanish person. To one group, he would present himself as an Austrian. To one, he would present himself as a Japanese person. And to one, he would introduce himself as an indigenous Peruvian who was born and raised on a stray island in the Titicaca Lake. And then the guided tours always lasted for 2 hours, and he would do a normal guided tour. He was dressed the same way all in all of the tours, so he always kind of wore an almost invisible kind of dress, black, very neutral. You wouldn't think about his dress. And he would do exactly the same tour. And after 1 hour, he would stop and sit down with this group, normally comprised of 15 people, and he would explain to the group what he was doing, that this was part of a research project, and that he presented himself with just one part of his identity, and that he would like to know from the people how they have perceived his guided tour, how they would have perceived the way he would introduce them to art, and as well of him as a qualified member of the educational team. And in all of the cases, just 3 people left angry because they felt like cheated or betrayed. In all the other cases, people started to engage in a very interesting discussion with him. And suddenly we found exactly the situation we strived for at Documenta 12 Education Program, that people would talk about what the educational situation in the gallery actually means and how the people who are part of this every single situation would determine what is happening there and would determine also the perception of art. Because the results were quite surprisingly non-surprising, because people responded when he had introduced himself as an Austrian, somebody from Austria, people felt like impatient with him. They thought he was a migrant child, and they were thinking about, you know, how grand it is from Documenta to employ somebody like that. And they wouldn't actually kind of not be, they weren't very astonished that he is, that he has a lot of knowledge in contemporary art. But when he was introducing himself as an indigenous person from Peru, people were totally amazed about how much he knew about contemporary art. And they were especially attentive when he was talking about a work by Ines Dujak, which was about the exploitation of natural resources in the Amazonian region. And when he was introducing himself as a Japanese person, people were not astonished at all that he has a lot of knowledge about contemporary art, because Japanese people tend to have this knowledge. This is the general perception. They are knowledgeable anyway, in contrast to the indigenous person, obviously. And they were especially attentive and thought he had a very and wonderful and interesting knowledge about everything related to Asia in the exhibition. So it was very interesting, and I give you this as an example because we are talking about risk today, and I think Hansel took an enormous risk in this moment, and also the institution risked a lot to let these kind of things happen. And in his essay, he's also talking about that he has not been able to be the master of the ceremony because by introducing himself as with one part of his identity, that also ruled his own thinking and also his own way of expression. And so it's not like he was manipulating the rest, but he was more interested in how these kind of articulations, we perform the museum, we perform the exhibition, and we perform the educational situation. So the title is Performing Essentialism at Documenta 12. All this was only made possible because the institution, I would say, I mean, we are talking about a biennale, and one has to separate between the artistic directors of Documenta and the actual institution, which is the continuous body of staff, which is a very small body of staff, executive manager, financing, you know, who is permanently in Kassel and is now already very busy with organizing the next Documenta. I think this part of the institution, the artistic directors, they were really into education, and that gave us actually the possibility to try these kind of risky things out. Just for the people of you, because I never expect anybody to know what Documenta is about. It is regarded as the most important exhibition of contemporary art, drawing attention from all over the world. So this is, of course, self-description of Documenta on its website. And on the website you also find figures, which usually used as a proof for success in all our contexts, so you can read them yourself. Documenta happens every 5 years and lasts 100 days and has usually like around 700,000 paying guests, and always striving to reach the million, of course. So also one has to keep in mind that there is no tradition at all at Documenta to conduct education at all. Documenta was established in the 1950s after the Second World War as, if you like, an educational project, but without education. It was the intent to reestablish what in National Socialism was destroyed as entartete Kunst, degenerated art, and to force the German public, who was, of course, the mainstream didn't stop after the Second World War was over, so people were actually guided into a re-education program by visiting Documenta at that time. And the program was not to talk and not to reflect and not to develop your own interpretations, but totally the opposite, to contemplate and to contemplate and to keep your mouth shut. So there's actually no tradition at all, and so that was quite an innovation. If you see it for Documenta as an institution, that education was not only introduced with these various activities, but also as one of three main pillars or main concepts of the curatorial work at Documenta 12. So that put a certain imperative on our work, which was quite unusual, because the artistic directors of Documenta actually asked us to receive the education at Documenta as critical practice. I think that is quite unusual. I mean, maybe not here anymore and maybe not at Tate anymore, but I think it is quite unusual that the director of a museum or of an exhibition or a biennale asks his educators or her educators to conduct the educational program as a critical reflection of education itself, but also of the event itself. So these were our approaches. We strived for pluralism and transparency of methods, also pluralism of profiles and subject positions of educators, also of age. It was our youngest educator was like 20 and the oldest was 80. Then public debate instead of the mere delivery of authorized knowledge. Active invitation to local and also translocal interest groups to participate in projects. A critical approach towards the institution and the exhibition, so gallery education not so much as transporting the authorized voice of curators or whoever, also the artist, but more of a critical friend. And experimenting with deconstructive methods and performative interventions, like Hansel did, which I introduced you in the beginning, and also a self-reflexive approach, and that was the team-based action research project. Now, as we talk about learning by the institution and risk-taking by the institution, one thing which really impressed me by the presentation of the young colleagues here was that you all mentioned that you have a budget. And I thought, wow, this is really great, an educational activity with a budget. At Documenta, one has to question the amount or the maybe the depth of dedication towards the educational issue from the institution because there was no budget at all provided for this. I mean, I got for my own post as a researcher, there was a budget, then there was one salary for the head of education, and he had two interns, and that was it basically. Because education at Documenta is actually considered as a means for the generation of income and not for expenditure. So people have to pay for the guided tours, and the educators earn what people pay. Yeah, they earn per hour, and they earn just part of it. Another part of what they pay for the guided tour goes to Documenta as an organization. And of course, you can imagine, therefore this word is written here, that creates a lot of tension. If the brief is actually that you have to provide, you should provide a critical reflection, public debate, experiment, performance, and then you have an audience who paid for a ticket to get a guided tour and expects value for money. And in this tension, we worked actually all the time. So that also created a lot of stuff to think about in the framework of the team-based action research project. So 20 of the 70 educators associated themselves within this research team as reflexive practitioners. The research workshop lasted 3 hours every day, and as I said before, in this time we developed the research questions and the designs, and also we followed through the actual research of every member. And as with Hansel, many of the research methods were also education methods. Yeah? Because also his work or his approach fitted very well to the curatorial concept, because the artistic director of Documenta 12 decided that he wouldn't provide any background information of any artist except of the name. And that was exactly for that reason, because they said if people read more, like the national background, for example, or the age, they will immediately start to develop preconceptions connected to this, about the work, connected to this information. And so Hansel could actually, his discussion, could link his discussion with the public, with his groups, very much to this curatorial decision, which of course, as a curatorial decision, caused a lot of aggression in the audience, because everybody wanted to know where the artists were coming from, and also about their age. There's one thing, and here we talk again about risks, and many people also wrote about that or reflected about that then in the publication which came out afterwards. The accomplishment of the research on the job had two effects. It was, on one hand, it was empowering because you realized you can actually work with problems and turn them into something productive. And also you have a group to reflect on them. But on the other hand, it was destabilizing because they were doing the work and at the same time they were observing themselves by doing the work. And you can imagine that this kind of double or meta level has also very destabilizing effect. So these are the two books which came out of the project. Volume 1, Documenta 12 Education, presents like a documentation of everything we did. It also has a DVD in it. It presents a lot of projects, documentations, also sound files and products which came out of the work. And Volume 2 presents the results of the research project. And if you are curious, you can have a look and you can even buy it today at the reception in the afternoon. Examples for some topics of research, and I think these examples will also show the risky side of this part of the work. We had some reflections of methods, like the productiveness of routines. Routines usually are considered as something negative, but this colleague actually focused on why you need them and what is the productive side of them. Then also productive moments in the use of poetical language in the educational situation in the exhibition. methods to reflect the authorized speaker's position, then questions around normalization, discrimination. One I just presented to you was Hansel's project, about attributions related to gender, whiteness, origin, accent within gallery education. And also some people developed approaches of what an anti-racist and anti-sexist practice within gallery education could be. Linked to this is one interesting article about gallery education and queer activism, but also about dress, dance, performance in gallery education, and an historical study about the programmatic absence of education at Documenta 1. I'm almost finished. I'm okay with time?
Couple of minutes.
Oh, good. Really? Or am I too late already?
No.
Okay, good. It feels like I'm talking already quite a long time. I chose some examples from colleagues who try to find performative ways to question the authorized voice of the gallery educator. For example, here down, Julia Ziegenbein, she had this T-shirt, and in the front, maybe some of you can read German, it says, "Believe me," and in the back it says, "Not a word." And so while she was doing the tour, she was, of course, showing herself from both sides, and at a certain point, people started to engage and talk to her about the T-shirt and if they should believe or not. And then it was a very easy entrance to a kind of talk about what truth means within a contemporary art environment. Or Barbara Campana, who tried out several methods how you can do mediation of performance art via performance methods. And so she was kind of reenacting, during her guided tours, she was reenacting performative works who were shown at Documenta 12. And here you see her running away from her group suddenly with a okay, last but not least, some of the learning outcomes of these risks and experiments. I think, of course, in the framework of a biennale, you just can't have such kind of long-term projects. You can, of course, work with local groups, also in between the biennales and prepare the next one and just continue and be independent from the actual exhibition. But most of the things you do are basically one-offs. They are short workshops. Maybe they last a day. We had some things in the children and youth program who lasted a day. But it is about short encounters. So what could people take out of these short encounters? I think some learned that what they experienced in these encounters was more interesting than the service provision they actually expected, and that an art exhibition can be a place for public debate and collective thinking, and obviously as well for unexpected encounters, not only with artworks, but also with people. And I think the educators took out that problems which appear to be personal are often shared and structural or political, that they are a professional community, and that they can theorize their practice as reflexive practitioners, but not all the time, because this has also limits, as I already tried to indicate. And also what I think is important is that risk needs to a certain extent a safe environment to be productive, and that is actually the moment where one has to start to talk about resources and, of course, also about trust. Anna, you mentioned it already, and about backing from the institution. And I think that was a problem in this special context of Documenta 12. I mean, the part to which I was invited here had the title Institutional Change, Rhetoric and Reality. And I have to say, I still question myself and do not get my head around whether it was rhetoric or reality in this case. And I think it is a very complex issue to discuss, but I want to, which I usually never do, in this case, I want to finish with some complaints. As I already mentioned, there was hardly any funding from the institution, but there was a big a task to fulfill. And although there wasn't provided any funding, there was still some significant level of control. This is the trust issue here. And in this situation, without funding, with a big task, and with some significant level of distrust and control, there was at the same time an enormous public attention, a pressure to be successful, and at the same time, a little resources of everything. Because as education was part of the curatorial concept, people were really curious, and some were disappointed because they didn't find what we did experimental enough. So that was, you know, the other side of the coin. Of course, there was, as always, or mostly always, things seem to change here, education at a very low level within the institutional hierarchy and hardly any influence on decision-making. And I think the next documenter might not have an education program again, because the myth of documenter, what is really institutionalized, is that the artistic director has a carte blanche and can decide his or herself whether they have an educational program or not. I always say that's a myth, because no artistic director could decide not to have an exhibition. Yeah. So the exhibition is institutionalized, the educational part is not. And so, yeah, I'm thinking and thinking whether it was rhetoric and reality. Yeah, thanks.
Right, has everyone had a moment to draw breath? As you can see from the schedule, we now have an opportunity for a kind of discussion. And Carmen and Anna, you've already been introduced to, but I would like to introduce the two other panel members here. First of all, we have Barbara Taylor, who is the director of the Inquire program. And Barbara's going to, in a minute, we'll give us a bit more detail about Inquire. I'm not going to do that on her behalf. But also, we have Sian Brown, who is the head of curation and senior curator of visual art at Museum Sheffield. And Museum Sheffield are one of the partner organisations in the Visual Dialogues programme. And again, Sian will probably, well, definitely give a bit more information about that. And really, it's my task here just to perhaps to prompt and start a discussion. I've found the presentations up until now absolutely fascinating, and I think they've raised a huge number of issues around the notion of risk and who is taking risk and how can we perhaps... I mean, there's a general sense that risk is a good thing, is what I'm getting from, but risk has to be, in a sense, looked at quite carefully. And risk within the context of learning has to be looked at quite carefully. One of the things that has occurred to me is that kind of age-old thing saying that God is in the details. And it strikes me that a lot of what happens that's interesting and can facilitate risk happens in the detail, that one can have great ambitions and you can set up programs, but in the sense... in the nature of the exchange, almost, is where the risk is taken. And one of the first questions, really, I'd like the panel to kind of think about is how, in the programmes that they've been familiar with, learning programmes, how have they seen how that practice and perhaps the details of that practice inform and impact on, particularly on the institution? And I use that term institution quite loosely, so, you know, it's up to people to interpret it how they will. And I'm going to turn to you, Barbara, and ask you to think about that question.
Is it okay if I introduce what about Inquire?
Yes, please
first.
Do.
I think most people are probably familiar with Inquire, but I'll give a little bit of background anyway. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm deaf and blocked all one side, so I can't tell. Inquire started in 2004. It's part of a larger programme called Strategic Commissioning for Museum and Gallery Education, funded by DCMS and DCSF. It's quite a big programme across the MLA, all the nationals. And Inquire is the strand of the programme that just looks at contemporary art. And the funding comes from the government through the Arts Council, and the programme's managed by Engage. Engage, you probably all know, is National Association for Gallery Education. And project work is quite an important part of Engage. Watch this space, Inquire, Envision, Visual Roots. There's a sort of ongoing programme of projects which are involved in developing new practice, research, articulating practice, case studies, advocacy, and so on. I think one of the important things to say about Inquire is that it's funded projects with children and young people, which started off in the first two phases as action research. It was structured as an action research programme. And the important part of that was that we wanted to investigate exactly what the learning benefits to children and young people are of engaging with contemporary art, the gallery, and with artists. The main aim of strategic commissioning is to develop capacity for increasingly effective gallery and museum education. But I think Engage in the Arts Council felt that the practice wasn't well enough understood or documented. And I think what Inquire has done by doing research and by publishing is, in a way, given the sector the means of articulating some of the factors, some of the learning benefits, the conditions that enable that learning, and to support advocacy. And articulating the benefits and the practice and advocating is as much to do with the institution, people's own institution, as it is to do with partnerships and to do with funding. So I think that's very relevant today. There have been, I think, three aspects of Inquire that have involved risk. One is about young people working with contemporary art and with artists, and the kind of space that provides for young people to take risks in a way that they perhaps aren't able to within the education system. For many institutions, it meant that they could undertake new work, test new partnerships, get involved in more risky practice through the programme. And it's meant professionals developing sort of communities of critical inquiry and, in a way, opening themselves up so gallery educators, teachers, youth workers, artists working very closely together. And to do that, you have to expose yourself to a certain extent. So that's risky. But all of those context, the young people, professionals coming together and working, institutions undertaking new work, all those risks have been supported by the programming. I think several people have mentioned trust and support. The small amount, it is quite a small amount of funding to Inquire, but what the funding has done, I think, is to enable institutions and individuals to do new work in a kind of supported, financially supported way, but also in these communities that provided support. And I think it's very difficult to take risks unless there's some sort of feeling of security and some feeling of support. And I think all the professionals, all the young people, have had to develop trust between everybody, all the parties, and that's enabled that risk. I think interesting in terms of the institution, the people who've taken part in Inquire have really valued the communities of critical inquiry aspect and the non-formal learning that's occurred through these partnerships between different professions. And people often say that it's not only an aspect of Inquire that they really value, but that they wish it took place across institutions. So that it's one thing for artists, gallery educators, teachers to form these peer networks, and particularly for gallery educators to form peer networks across local areas. But they wish that it happened across the different professions within galleries. And we're looking at ways that could be done, particularly in a project across Europe. But as far as other aspects of institutional change goes, we're carrying out some evaluation at the moment about the legacies of Inquire. Inquire wasn't set up to look at institutional change, but we're going to try and do so retrospectively now that we've had 6 years of the programme. What we've tended to see is the programme and innovative work and bringing young people into more decision-making roles in the gallery has enabled galleries to raise funding, to set aside space, to raise the profile of the education learning programmes within the institutions in a very practical way. So there are dedicated spaces in some institutions. There are dedicated posts where there weren't before.
Thank you. I mean, I think this is thank you, Barbara, that's really useful. And I think perhaps if I turn to you, Sian, because I think perhaps a lot of what Barbara's just said might resonate with you and the kind of experience you might have had, particularly in relation to the Visual Dialogues project, which was set up with, you know, with the idea of bringing young people perhaps into the heart of the institution and enabling them to have a very active role within that.
I mean, first of all, just to say a little bit about Museums Sheffield, we've got four sites across Sheffield, one of which is a museum, one is a historic house, and then there are two galleries, so we're quite a diverse service. And one of the things that happened after we opened the museum was a restructure that put the curatorial team and the learning team within the same directorate. So we're starting from a position where we've really got a united team to look at everything. We've been working on Visual Dialogues now for probably around 5 years, and it's really come on board with a number of other strategic commissioning projects as well. So we have one with the National Portrait Gallery and one with the V&A as well. But really, Visual Dialogues is the one that has really pushed us, I think, most forward into actually thinking about how young people could become involved in the institution. It's based around our youth forum. We previously had a youth forum and we had Visual Dialogues, and we suddenly had a revelation that actually putting them together would be so much stronger, and actually that would involve developing our informal offer much better. So we've worked with these young people. It's an evolving group of people. Again, it's the age range of roughly 15 to 18, and they come to see us every week and have built a really strong relationship, particularly with the Graves Art Gallery. We chose quite early on to look at the Graves Gallery because it's actually quite a traditional gallery. It's quite inaccessible. Unlike the Millennium Gallery, which is very publicly accessible, has a lot of people walking through it every day, Graves is difficult to get to. It's on the top of a library building, and people don't know it's there. So we felt that if we could engage this group of young people with the works on display in the Graves, actually we could make a huge step forward. Right from the word go, we have always worked with a curator and a learning person on Visual Dialogues, and actually built into the funding of both of those posts was the idea that they would work together. So from the beginning, we've thought about it like that. In terms of taking risk and being brave in what we do is a key part of what we would like to be able to do at Museum Sheffield. So Visual Dialogues fits perfectly with our values to start with, which is a fantastic opportunity, really. We've invited young people over the years to create interpretation, which we then place within the gallery space. And along with other things we've been working on, it has really opened up the art curators in particular to feel much more confident and much more free with what might go into those spaces. So we started, I read back in anticipation of this event, to look at the notes for some of the first meetings or the first Visual Dialogue sessions, and listening to the curators and what they said and how they talked about young people and how they talked about how they would be involved and the worries that they had. And it actually quite surprised me, because I thought we were very open to start with. But actually you see the progression through that time, where actually now we're wanting to challenge the young people to do new things. We're saying, well, isn't that a little bit like last year? What more could they do? And question what they're doing even more.
Thank you, Sian. I mean, I think that it's interesting how quickly kind of themes start emerging, one of which being obviously the importance of a time, that this kind of practice doesn't happen overnight, and that trust is
clearly key, and the that kind of same old, which unless you're resourced properly, you can have the best intentions in the world, but practice, revolutionary or radical or not, is simply not going to happen. But I think that one of the things that perhaps we haven't thought about, and but Carmen was very evident, particularly I noticed in that slide of your, which I have to say I find wonderful, the idea of your gallery or your educator running away from her group, which strikes me as a very, very radical gesture in the sort of truest sense of the word. And one of the things I'd like to think about is that we talk a lot about kind of creative practice and risk taking, and you know really trying things. And yes, and we build in scope for failure. And I'd really like us to take a kind of honest look at how much of the practice that we do really, really does that, and whether that's a realistic thing to ask, and how much that we ask participants and young people to do this whilst knowing that ultimately the institution cannot be seen to fail, and so cannot, there's a limit to the amount of risks that it can take. And I'm going to hand that to you, Anna.
Thanks.
That's all right.
Well, I've been thinking two things, because there's, you know, there's so much to say about all this, but risk without purpose seems to me insanity. You know, that, you know, you just do something because it's a risk, you know, is a pointless exercise. And I think in a way that's what people, you know, that is the worst kind of risk. So what do we mean by risk? And sometimes I think all we mean by risk is trying something new. You know, and why then is that a risk? And the risk is that people are uncertain as to what it means to the institution, for its profile, its reputation, and all those things. So if we understand that as what we mean by risk. But I think I'd like to come back actually to what Sean was saying, which was, for me, a lot of it's about talk and language. That in fact, I've seen a shift in people's language in terms of how we talk about what a risk is. So that, you know, the conversation you have with someone about what you want to do, you know, can be, you know, they're going to take over the gallery, it'll all be fine. Or it can be, we've sorted this out and we've got young people and they're, you know. I think there's a, I really think that there is an expertise in language that is about intelligent persuasion for good. And I was thinking that it's really interesting because, you know, I try not to, yeah, it's a complication, but I try, all learning happens in the same way. Every human being learns in the same way. We don't learn informally and we don't learn formally. They are two different sets of techniques that happen in our cognitive capacities. We all learn in the same way. We just have different environments. We either have a kind of structured formal environment that might be set up for us to pass exams, and there might be what we call the informal or the non-formal environment. And the talk in those two things is completely different. And I did a bit of research on it about 5 years ago, where there is, in formal education, young people talk to each other, that is to say, one person speaks, another person speaks back, 5 minutes in a six-hour day. 5 minutes. Which is a bit frightening, isn't it? In an informal environment, or a non-formal, they talk to each other 99% of whatever the time is. And I think that that's really significant, that actually we're encouraging the development of thought, language and ideas for within the informal, and we're actually stopping it in potentially informal systems. And I've definitely noticed that I've taken that model of that kind of informal, you know, trying not to formalise one's talk into generating more risk than there actually is. You know, I think actually we can talk ourselves into really risky positions that don't exist. And I think that there is, I mean, I'm probably not making a lot of sense, but I think that there's something really important about it, and that language and how we talk with one another is actually about respect and exchange. And I just know that the ways in which I'm now having hundreds of conversations as in this new job, and that makes a big difference, because often people just haven't been spoken to before to actually think the thought that you're trying to have a conversation about. Don't know where that takes us.
It takes me somewhere.
Okay, yeah, thank God for that.
Yeah. All right. I'm off. What it makes me think is that one of the forums where, in a sense, you can think about these kind of ideas in an interesting way is if you frame what you're doing as research. Mm. And hence, you know, and this is where I return to you, Carmen, where this idea that because you framed a certain amount of your practice as research, did it give you a space which, in a sense, permitted a kind of different type of activity that framing it as education contextualizes it differently?
First, I have to object to Anne. because you said risk-taking is basically about trying out something new. And I think that's right, but it's not the only thing. It is also about taking a position. It can be really risky to take a position. Of course, it depends which position you take, but I think that is, especially in our work, it is the more risky thing, if it's not the position which is not risky. Yeah. Yes. And we made this experience a lot at Documenta. There was this one example when there was a media campaign which tried to pornographicize. Can you say that? Pornographization. Yeah, you know what I mean. Yeah. And immediately a discourse about child protection came up. And I think you are very familiar with this discourse here. It was really a big scandal, and it was in the TV and in all the papers. And when the local papers started to announce that they will now establish a telephone hotline for parents of traumatized children, we started to react as the education department of Documenta, and we offered a workshop which was about giving the young people and the children the possibility to be experts on what they can see and what they can't see. And also we made a public discussion, and I think about 400 people joined, because sex, of course, always sells, which introduced the difference between the child protection and radical sex education discourse. And it caused a lot of debate, and I think that was also very risky for the institution. So that was not only about trying out something new, but also about taking a position which might not be the hegemonical position of the time. And I think, of course, if you do things like that in a research framework, it allows for more risk, or at the same time, it kind of the real risk is kind of on a lower level, because you're allowed to try out things that is what is research about. But then I think in the end of the day, it depends on the institution whether you need this framework just to take some risks. Yeah, I think the difference is actually, or the more risky thing for the institution is, if things which are tried out are based on research, then actually normally the institution is obliged to do something with that afterwards. You know what I mean? I mean, this is another level of what the label of research might cause as a risk for the institution. Because if you just have some innovative or creative or crazy educators who get the allowance to do some performances, that's fine. Yeah, it depends on the curator or the director how open-minded he or she is. But if you frame this as research and you come up with some results and they are printed and communicated, then suddenly the institution is in face of the decision of what are we going to do with this? Will we bury it, or are we going to take that on and pursue?
Absolutely, yeah. Which I think, you know, going back to what Barbara is saying about, you know, you need to kind of get to the end of perhaps or at particular points in whatever activity you're doing, and take a moment to kind of pause and reflect and take stock of, and look back and think where you know, and as Sian said, where did we start from and how much have we moved on, because so much of this practice happens in the doing, and I think that the doing can go on, and this perhaps is an example of one of those moments where people get an opportunity to stop and go, ooh, goodness me, how things have changed, or goodness me, nothing's changed at all. Now, why is it that these things happen so fast? Do you think you have all the time in the world, and we need now to have a moment for people in the audience to ask questions. Now, I'm conscious that the our four speakers are not here with us. Can I just say they will be coming back this afternoon? They are going to be sitting on a panel discussion this afternoon. So if that's okay, I will... unless someone has a very specific question that they would like to ask one of them, in which case I will call them up here to answer it. If these questions could be directed more at the panel here. And does anyone have a burning... Ooh, lots of goodie.
Yeah.
why don't we start with this? There's a roving mic, so if you can bear to wait until... Yes, Jocelyn, if you pass it to the lady there, if you can. And if you could introduce yourself, too.
Hello, my name's Lottie Child. I'm an artist. And I wonder what you mean by research. Is it the methodologies you use? Does it have to be affiliated with an academic institution? How do you mean the word research?
Carmen, do you want to go and then if needs be other people can chip in?
I could now repeat the kind of, you know, there are kind of five quality indicators when something you do is considered to be research. It also depends, of course, what kind of research you want to undertake. And we were very much in the framework of participatory action research and working with the educators as reflexive practitioners. And in this framework, research means that you develop a question, you develop a research design, you carry that design out as systematically as possible. You might even redesign it in the process, but it has to be carried out as planned. And then you have a thorough way of working with this data, which have come out of this process. You record, you write a fieldwork diary, and then you take the data you collected as a basis for your interpretation. And then you come to some conclusions, or very well-grounded theses, and then you write them down and communicate them to different communities and get some feedback whether this research was solid or not. I think that is research.
Also, I mean, as you said, Inquire was initially framed as action research. And how important was it, do you think, at the beginning? And what did research mean in the context of the beginning of that program?
Well, I think Carmen's described it very well. I think it's fair to say that action research and participatory action research are pretty contested terms, and a lot of people in academic circles tend to avoid using them, I think, because they're quite sort of moulded, I suppose, to different situations. But I think that's the strength of the model or models. I think in the first two phases of Inquire, the sort of action research teams were comprised of gallery educators, artists, youth workers or teachers, and university researchers. And the aim was to be totally democratic and participatory, so that in that context, the academics would be sort of equal members of that research team and in a sort of supportive role, and their expertise would be in research, whereas the gallery educator would have a different form of expertise, the artist would have another form of expertise. The models got slightly kind of contaminated, I suppose, largely, sometimes because of inevitable hierarchies, sometimes just because of time. I mean, if you want to develop a sort of truly participatory action research model, it's incredibly lengthy. It's like lots of things we've been talking about today anyway. You know, everyone's going to have their voice. You know, the question emerges out of debate. The question's revised in debate. The project's developed collaboratively. It's, you know, the methods of evaluation are arrived at democratically. So it's incredibly lengthy. So that was a bit of an issue. And so there's a bit of shortcut here a long way. And then the other thing that we didn't do properly, I think, to be fair, is to involve the participants in the sense of young people in that participatory research. So in the end, and I mean, what participatory action research shouldn't be is research about people by other people. And actually, all the action research worked really well with teens, in the sense that, you know, they reflect about themselves, they reflect about the practice. But with some notable exceptions, there wasn't always a lot of involvement by the young people. And again, that would have taken even longer. So it is a kind of movable model, if there is a model. And I think it's a very interesting way of working. I think it's interesting that probably artists are action researchers, and I think a lot of gallery educators are quite natural action researchers. And although Inquire isn't doing research anymore, I can't stop people doing research, because every time we advertise a phase of the programme, including the current phase, people always come to me with a research question and a proposal to reflect on their practice jointly with our professionals, which is just great practice. So you can't, you know, not trying to stamp it out. I think it's become a bit of a habit in the sector, and it's a very healthy habit.
Let's go back.
Is it on?
Oh, okay. Sounded really quiet. I've got a question which I'm sure you come across quite a lot.
Can you give your name?
My name's Harriet Godwin. I'm a curator at the Norwich Castle Museum. And it's about institutional critique. And I think so many artist educators and even young people are encouraged to come into the museum context to in some way kind of criticise or make the institution reflect upon itself. And I wanted to ask Carmen how that worked with your guides and how they felt about being kind of forced to reflect. And a lot of their approaches seemed incredibly creative and very artistic, that a lot of the performances you would have seen perhaps, you know, as part of institutional critique. So, and also to sort of ask other people on the panel about how we can escape that, or how we can fight against it, or find new ways of dealing with that.
I think we actually tried to develop more a kind of post-institutional critical approach, where the institutional critique is not the aim, but more a means to engage people in a discussion about the potentialities of the exhibition and the work and document as a thing. You come and can use as a resource to work with. And because most of the gallery educators were actually quite identified with the exhibition, so it wasn't so much about just criticizing it because you have to be critical, but more to develop interventions which kind of lead the discussion to other levels beyond the mere explanation of artworks. And I think you can do that in many ways. And there's a wonderful handbook which was developed by Tate, how you can also do it. And I think it was basically about this. And also it was self-reflexive in a way, not so much institutional critically, but more an intent to reflect on education via doing it. Not so much on the institution or the exhibition, but on education itself. Does that answer a bit? Yeah.
I don't know, Sian, if you want to...
Yeah, I mean, I think for Museum Sheffield, it's more a question of what we do with that critique. I think it's very positive to go through that process, but actually, in the long term, what do we do with it? We can find out about all of these projects. We can ask people to critique. And I think the question is then, how do we react to that? How do we make that an ongoing process so it isn't a set project that then ends? Because I think the danger with company with the funding situation is that you will invite people, artists, young people, researchers, and actually you have a very finite amount of resource and that ends, and then what can you do? So I think what we're looking at, certainly with the next year, is to think about how we actually create things that are sustainable and how we respond genuinely to comment and to any kind of critical research that there is.
Well, I think there is a difference between criticism and critique, of course. You know, criticism is kind of understood to be, you know, my understanding is that it's a kind of negative approach, whereas I think of critique as creativity, you know, that actually forming a critique invites a construction of a new intervention that will take us forwards, rather than just kicking what doesn't work. And, you know, I do think that institutionally, I think it's quite interesting that learning or education has often taken the position of the criticiser and not the critiquer. So there's a lot of being very cross about things. But that isn't the way you change things, and that isn't the way you start to embed shifts in practice. And in a way, the bigger risk is to have the conversation. The bigger risk is to stand up for your position and try to persuade an alternative. And that is what I think critique is, that you are brave enough to move forwards and try to change that position. Criticism, I think, leaves us in a kind of smug position of knowing the problem, but not providing any of the answers.
I mean, I think just to kind of develop that as well, I think that sometimes education within the art institution can reside kind of on the outskirts, but it likes that. It likes being there because it can do the kind of criticism and then retreat or you know, remain where it is. And I think one of the kind of ambitions for this kind of practice is to be to step beyond that and go, we will engage in an interesting and creative dialogue and take responsibility for being right at the centre, rather than that slightly privileged position of being on the outside looking in. No, do you want to come down here?
Hi, my name is James. I'm a fine arts student. I was wondering, to go back to the theme of language, what effects do you think the language that frames art institutional learning practice has on risk-taking within participants of the art institutional learning practice?
Language is your gig?
I think it's huge, to be honest. I think that we are really brilliant at stopping things really profoundly through language. You know, thank you. No, aren't we? You know, I mean, you know, there are brilliant. Well, I listen to it every day, the construction of language that organises people so that you pull the carpet away from them before they've even started. We're really expert at it. We're really less expert at properly listening and responding back with genuine questions. I mean, I think that's one of the issues that I think is really interesting here, that research is a genuine question, that is genuinely trying to find something. And I think we've had a practice that's been based on a lot of inductive, you know, research, you know, where we keep on finding things like they're a surprise every half hour. You know, instead of taking a view that we might go, oh, hang on, we've done this 100 times, might there be a theory here that this is happening? And then we test against it. And all that language, all that shaping of who we are, I mean, I think how we talk is who we are, and how we talk as an institution becomes who we are. So if we never talk about young people, if we never talk about what we might do, if we never talk about risk, you can be pretty sure that it's not going to happen because no one's talking about it. You know, and I have, I mean, and it's fascinating because I've had some conversations recently, and no one is evil or terrible or vicious, you know, I say. People simply haven't had the conversation to hook in what our narrative is and what our conversation is. So I think it has a huge impact, because if you don't have the language to talk about what you're doing, it's not going to be out there. And I don't think necessarily, I mean, I think we've got better at it, but I still think we don't articulate what it is we do particularly well. But I do think we use language as a not helpful weapon sometimes.
Yes, I would like to just to make a short remark. In the research project at Documenta 12 Education, we had a lot of thinking about how you silence people by being eloquent, and how language could, how you can actually unlearn as a gallery educator to be eloquent all the time, and to conceive language more as something which is full of gaps and lacks and failing. And everybody was talking about their experiences, that the desired dialogue with the audience started to develop when they were not finding words, and I mean when the educator themselves would not find the right words and would start to stutter, and then people suddenly had the possibility to say something. And there's one article has the title "How to Silence the Educator."
I think as well there's that issue around a lot of the discourse around this kind of practice. Is framed in terms of kind of giving voice to people, enabling people to have a voice. And it's a very kind of seductive notion, but I think it's one of those things that requires real interrogation. What does it mean to give someone a voice? And you can give someone a voice, and then do you actually listen to what's been said? Because people can talk and talk, and if you don't listen, just frankly, is, you know, it's insulting. I don't know if you want to add.
Well, just on a really practical level, one of the inquiry groups of galleries did some early research about language, and what they discovered was that artist teachers and gallery educators had completely different understandings of quite normal words like creative or enjoy or workshop, or, you know. So you can actually be having a discussion or planning a project and you're all kind of going along parallel lines and never meeting. I had an experience of that once, because I think the Association for Business Sponsorship of the Arts, about 10 years ago, I went to a really interesting seminar where they put up words in two different columns, and it was like the arts sector use of language and the business sectors. And they were in many cases, totally opposing, not just different understanding. So you realize you could have a meeting with a sponsor, and again, you're just like, the discussion is just going like that. Lots of nodding and goodwill, and absolutely no common understanding at all.
I'd say that's probably true inside an organisation, an institution in itself. I think having a shared language and a shared understanding of that language is really imperative. So the learning, curatorial, marketing, all of those teams actually have a real and genuine understanding of that discussion. And I think what you were saying, Emily, in terms of listening, I think listening is vital, but actually acting on that is even more important.
Hi, my name is Harry. I'm a practitioner. I'm also a student at Chelsea, and I'm an educator at Chelsea as well. My question's to do with the use of the word practice. I think it's a very interesting word, and in particular, thinking about it applied to someone like Anton Vidicol, whose work through United Nations Plaza in the building following Veiled Manifesto 6 in Berlin, and then art school in New York. The fact that he, being a practitioner, and I think... talking about the educators at Documenta 12 being practitioners, allows what they're doing to become something more than just education. And I think perhaps the word practitioner is really interesting and perhaps really key to this, perhaps more so than the use of the word either education or research.
Do you want to start?
Well, I think it is almost more a comment than a question. My immediate reaction was, but I'm actually trying to kind of reestablish the word education and to shift it as well, you know, from away from the just. Yeah. During the last 10 years, there has been a lot of thought going on about how education... is taking advantage or being enriched by art, but I would like to write a history about how art has been enriched and influenced by education. So, but I take it as an idea or suggestion. Yeah.
I mean, my own personal experience is as both an art practitioner and educator and a researcher. And what I discover increasingly is a kind of blurring between the three, so that I no longer feel comfortable kind of dividing or compartmentalising one and saying, you know, this is education, this is practice, and this is research. What I find interesting is kind of interrogating the spaces where they overlap and the in-between.
Sorry, just to clarify, by okay. practitioner, I didn't mean it as artist.
Okay. Mm.
So I was meaning practice as a term that is different from and building upon the terms artist, educator, and researcher, that somehow practice is now in the knitting together of all of them.
Yeah.
And somehow that the sum of all the parts the thing is greater than the sum of all its parts, and I think that's where practice becomes interesting beyond curatorship, sort of artist as a set term, educator as a set term, or researcher, or even theorist, perhaps.
I mean, again, the other thing I like about, because I like the term practitioner, and one of the reasons I like that term is because I think there's a whole notion of the kind of knowledge and expertise that comes through practice, that is I won't go off on one now, but that notion that you can have practice-based knowledge that comes through what you're doing, that can be informed by theory, but is based in the actual doing of what you do. And I see that as a very interesting place to start with in relation to this kind of activity.
I think I understood what you meant, and I like the idea, but I'm passing through a phase of radical redisciplination or something, because I'm a bit worried about the power relations which are connected to the different positions or positionalities which then melt within the term practitioners will not be considered enough, and then there will be a kind of invisible fight, and the well-known winner wins again or something like this. It's a complex thing, but still, thank you.
Yeah, down at the front.
Hi there. My name's Emily, and I'm a Museum and Galleries and Education student, and I also work for Oxford University Museums. I'm particularly interested in how you think these big discussions that we're talking about now, how they really roll out into smaller institutions, and whether smaller institutions really can take the risks that, you know, you're discussing now, and how we can avoid leaving them on the outskirts and leaving them to sort of stagnate.
Do you
want to...
I think in terms of the work we've done, there's various projects that we've embarked on within Yorkshire that have been funded through Renaissance in the Regions, where we've worked with much smaller institutions, Rotherham Art Gallery, Shandy Hall, to really develop new ideas of creative interpretation. So that's a very tangible way, and obviously that is a time-limited project, but that was all about taking risks and doing something that they had never done before, but in a sense with the knowledge that we had more experience and we were able to assist with that. I think we'd like to see that rolling out much more, and I think I'm keen that we do in the future. It's a shame it hasn't developed more, so we'd like to look at that. But I also think it's about a shift in mindset as much as to do with the size of an institution or the resources that you have. I think it's about the people who work there, and if they have a particular perspective and have an open-minded approach to taking risks or to how to work with other people or how they might want to involve young people, that will be what actually makes the difference, not the size of the organisation.
My experience is the opposite. The small institutions develop the radical stuff, which is then absorbed by the big ones.
That's true. We've got chance for one more.
It's Francis from the South London Gallery. We are quite a small institution. I'm not going to claim anything for that, but I do think smaller institutions, I've always compared us to a speedboat to Tate's liner, And I think the differences are ones of, there's lots of decks at Tate of hierarchies, and you can have lots of violins playing on the decks and stuff, whereas for us we might get submerged by a big wave or something, you know. So actually those sorts of risks, financial risks, play out in the kind of other kind of programming risks that we take. But on a basic level, I think perhaps having small people means that we're forced to communicate more easily than across big institutions. Sorry, that wasn't a question.
No, it's nicely answered, though. I think on that note, I think we're going to stop and have some lunch and carry on the conversation. And then if I can ask everyone to be back promptly at 2:00.